Co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Don't let Rupert Murdoch control your newscasts. The KBOO Evening News provides breaking news about local issues, from water fluoridation to immigration raids. We bring you daily coverage of what's going on in Portland, Cascadia, and around the world. Tune in every weekday at 5 for the KBOO Evening News on KBOO, your community radio station.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is approximately 9:01 a.m., Coming up, Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Portlanders Tammy Dean and Hossein Rojantalab, who recently returned from 7 months traveling in Iran, Hossein's country of origin. At 10, hear Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, a confirmation of the poisoning of Yasser Arafat, but by who? At 11 on The Digital Divide, host Rabia Yemen interviews author and editor-in-chief of The Economist website called Tom Standage. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still help us make up that $9,237 deficit by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs, and I'm happy to have with me in the studio Tammy Dean and Hossein Rojantalab, who recently returned from 7 months traveling in Iran. They left for Iran in March and returned in October. Hossein is a retired engineer with Intel who grew up in Iran. Tammy is a jeweler and a longtime KBOO volunteer who grew up in the United States. We're going to be talking about their trip and their experiences and the people of Iran who welcomed them into the country so graciously. And first, I'm going to ask Hossein to tell us a little about the music we just heard.
This music was Kurdish music, one of the ethnic group in Iran.
And is it modern music?
Oh, no, this is folklorish.
Ah, okay. Great. Thank you. So that was Hossein, and also, as I mentioned, with us is Tammy. I guess this question is for both of you. Why did you want to travel in Iran for this extended period of time?
That's a great question. Kathleen, thanks a lot for having us. It's going to be so fun to talk about Iran, because we had such a great trip. I wanted to go to meet Hossein's family. That was pretty much my focus, and everything I tried to research about before we went was kind of centered around that, knowing that periodically we would be going back to Tehran, using it as a hub during our various adventures. And that, for me, we have been together for nearly 20 years, and he's seen where I grew up. I had no clue what to expect. Well, no, that's not entirely true. I had my own wild ideas about what Iran was all about, and I wanted to get to know my husband a little differently and sort of learn about that facet of him. So that was my motive, primarily.
Hossein?
We went back because, as Tammy said, I wanted Tammy to see Iran, and she prepared for that by learning the language. And that took quite a while, although she's a linguist, and she's very keen in enunciating the words correctly, but the word structure is quite different than English. And so it took her about a year and a half to really get prepared. And by then she had read some books. And I hadn't been in Iran myself for about 14 years. The last time I was there was 1999. And so I was eager to go back. And the plan was to travel across the continent, which is quite big. And the Iran land is quite big. And so we managed to do that.
And had you experienced the whole whole Iran country before? Was this the first time you traveled to these places?
Very good question. Iran is a very large country. I looked up the internet, and it's like the 17th in size. Ironically, it's 17th in population as well. To give you a perspective, it's like as big as Alaska, which makes it like 2.5 times as big as Texas. Mm-hmm. And the landscape is really diverse and it's beautiful. There are two cascades in Iran and several isolated mountains. The cascade, one of them is Zagros, that goes from the north, south of Turkey, around Iraq border, all the way to the center, and then to the Persian Gulf. And the structure changes quite a bit. The color changes. And then the other one is in the northern region. It's called Alborz. The first one was Zagros. This is Alborz. And they go up as high as 14,000, 15,000 feet. And so that was before. I couldn't go there because the roads were not as good as now. Some of them were not even available. So the travel we made was 70% of it was new to me.
Mm. And it was different than the area that you grew up in?
Oh, quite different. I grew up in Tehran, and then I was a professor in Shiraz and Ahvaz, and I traveled quite a bit around those areas. But the places that we saw in the northeast, northwest, and this deep south was quite new to me.
And when you left Iran, was the Shah in power?
When I left first in 1964, yes, the Shah was in power. And then when I returned in 1976, the Shah was in power. And finally, when I left in 1985, of course, Shah was deposed. Mm-hmm.
So you've seen some changes in that way as well as many other ways, I would imagine.
Yes, we've seen changes in political situations, in the population, in the city dwellings, on the roads, and quite a lot of things. Like, I'm really interested in literature and history of Iran. We saw quite a lot of changes this time that we went.
Tammy, do you want to add anything about what we're talking about, sort of the scope of the traveling that you did, the amount of traveling that Hossein mentioned, and how big an area you actually traversed?
Yeah, I have lots to add. Hossein planned this trip so well. I didn't really understand all the entire, as you say, scope of what we were going to do after we landed in Tehran. I understood we were going to take trips, and I thought I pretty much knew the lay of the land. But by the time we were deep into our first excursion, which ended up quite long, how long? 2.5 months we were gone? And we went south to the Persian Gulf and then over to Bam. This is a bare skeleton. And then northwest again back to Tehran, going to into the desert and
Yeah, we went to the first one, as time said, we went all the way to Qesh. Mm-hmm. And in there we saw provinces like Kerman.
Nobody knows what Qesh is.
Yeah, Qesh is an island in the Persian Gulf. It's the biggest island in the Persian Gulf is inhabited, and the history of it goes back way before the BC, before Christ. And has a lot of natives still living there, and in fact, we lived 9 days with them, and it was one of the highlights of our trip. And then we went to provinces of Kerman, Yazd, Kashan, and then we went to Isfahan and Shiraz and Bakhtiar, and then we went back home, back to Tehran. And Tehran was the hub. And then we rested a while and visited with families.
And one of the things you said to me, Hossein, off mic, was that when you went to a different province, everything changed. You were sort of indicating how diverse the provinces are. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. As I started to say that how big the country is, historically, Iran has been populated by many different ethnicities. We have about more than a dozen different ethnical groups there. We have Lorish, Turkish, Bakhtiaris, Kurdish, just name a few. We have Arabs living around the Persian Gulf. We have Fars, of course, living all over. And they have their own languages. They all speak Farsi, but they all have their own unique language as well. And their music, and their clothing, their food. So to me, it was like in each province we went, it was like going to a different small country. Mm-hmm. Of course, we didn't need to get any visa to go in there, but it was as abrupt. And it was, again, those are very, very, very quite new to me.
And what was the reaction of people in the provinces when you encountered them and they encountered you?
They would take us both as a non-native foreigners. I could hear them when we were walking down the street or in the bazaar that say, oh, Kharijian means they're foreigners. They would talk to me in English, and then sometimes I would lead them that I'm an Iranian. Otherwise, they would think that I've learned Farsi and they would be very happy. And then they would ask about Tammy. And of course, Tammy had taken a Farsi name, Iranian name, Shabnam. So I would ask them to talk to her, and they would say, does she talk Farsi? And I would say, well, go ahead, talk to her.
And then what would Tammy say?
And then I would blunder my way through an interchange. I'm by no means fluent in Farsi, by the way. I can get my way. I can make my way through a conversation, a simple conversation, and my listening comprehension is pretty bare bones. But you know, there are so few travelers there to begin with from anywhere, and so few Americans that when they would learn I was American, and then I think to see Farsi coming out of this American mouth, it would either peals of laughter, that was was like a very common response. It was, you know, it was just so odd and a real disconnect. And or they would be just falling down, delighted to hear this language coming out of this foreign person. And it really didn't matter that I was making big mistakes. If I could say a few things like, I love your country, your people are incredibly warm and wonderful, and I'm so happy to be here. That was just said, it was like a blessing for them. Mm-hmm. They really, really, they were overjoyed.
Why are there so few travelers?
Well, I think Iran has done a pretty good job isolating itself from the rest of the world, particularly the Western world, for one reason or another. The reason Americans aren't there is because, by and large, Americans are afraid of Iran. And that was really sad to have to confront people with, because they would always ask me, you know, well, what do people think? You know, we love Americans. We love Americans. I mean, that was always the first thing. Oh, you're American. Oh, my God. What are you doing here? We love Americans. We want you to come here. And I mean, sometimes I felt like a celebrity being an American there. I can't really stress that enough. But but then they would say, what do Americans think of us? And I would have to say, you know, and sometimes I got very emotional about it. I have to tell you that our government has made us afraid of you. And I'm lucky to have a husband who comes from there, and I get to be here with you fabulous people and learning about your history and literature and family life. I mean, I just felt so fortunate. And anyway, that's why. Mm-hmm. You know, another big thing is that everything is in... There are some signs in English, but everything's written in Farsi. So primarily the people you do see traveling, Westerners, for example, you do see traveling there, are, you know, huddled in a little group with a guide or two.
Right.
And because you can't make sense of anything. The language is bizarre. Nobody studies Farsi. And the signage is, you know, hard to de-scramble.
Mm-hmm. And people were afraid for you, Tammy, before you went. And you mentioned that. And were you ever afraid while you were traveling?
No, I was never afraid. We were talking about this last night. We were remembering a story where we were in a little village. And we had been there maybe four or five months. We were on our second trip up in the northwest region, which is Lorestan and
Ilam, Hamadan.
Yeah. Anyway, up in the northwest, and we were in a little village. Somebody told us about a very interesting Aban Bar to go visit, and this is a water storage device, big, huge mud structure usually with, and then you walk down down steps into where the water has been flowing under in tunnels that have been dug. Anyway, I won't get into that now. It's incredible, but we looked and looked and looked, thought we found it. Turned out it wasn't the place, but instead all it was some guys in a hole taking a bath, and I didn't go down there. Hossein went and talked to them. They elected one representative to climb out, come up, get dressed, walk up the stairs, meet with us, get on his motorcycle, and take us off into the desert to find the real place. And we drove and drove and drove behind this guy with no road, just bumping in our little sedan, bumping over the sand dunes. And when we arrived at the place, all it was a hole in the ground. There was no big structure. It wasn't like what we had been accustomed to seeing. He starts off down the into this hole, and it got darker and darker. Luckily, I had brought a little flashlight. The thought occurred to me, anywhere else I've traveled, at this point in this little excursion, I would be thinking, where are we going? And who is this man? And It's pretty dark. He seems to know this very well. I have no clue. I can't see anything. I might have been frightened in another situation. In Iran, that thought passed through my head, and I thought, and it was amusing to me because I had no, obviously, this guy was just dedicated to showing us the water. And that was, that's a very good example of how comfortable I felt there.
You're listening to Tammy Dean, and also here with me is Hossein Rajantalab, and they are talking about their trip of 7 months traveling in Iran. We're going to hear another example of music from Iran. Hossein, do you want to tell us a little about this piece?
This is going to be a just the music, no words. Is going to be a bit santur, which is one of the Iranian traditional instruments, by a guy named Faramarz Paivar, and then the tumbak by the master Hossein Tehrani. Is this music is from Tehran.
Listening to some music from Iran. I'm here. My name's Kathleen Stevenson. I'm here with Tammy Dean and Hossein Rajantalab talking about their trip to Iran. They returned in October from 7 months there. And Tammy, when we were talking before, you were talking about this experience going down this hole with a flashlight and a guide, a sort of impromptu guide. I know that that experience kind of illuminates some other aspects of the issue of water in the country. Mm-hmm. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, yeah, sure.
Maybe Hossein does. I'm not sure which one of you wants to explain that a little bit.
I just will explain a little bit about what Tammy and Ogman, what you said, is that that qanat, that feature that you went to see, is the water underground, that Tammy will elaborate on that, is the longest and more highest volume of water, we call Qanat, underwater tunnels, in the world. And as she said, we drove from one opening to another opening for a long time. Go ahead.
And Hossein's talking about it like it was a really prominent feature and would have been visited by lots of people to see this amazing thing. But no. It was way out in the middle of nowhere and really pretty much just literally a hole in the ground. But we wanted to see it because we had learned about these Qanats around Yazd. We spent a long time in Yazd because there's so many fascinating things there. It's an old, old city. The old mud citadel walls are still intact, and you can see them. We actually stayed in the old town within these walls and learned a lot. There's a wonderful museum there, the Water Museum. And there, I really filled out my understanding about how water moves around in the desert of Iran. And they still use these technologies. And one way is, it was explained to me that they learned from the farmers thousands of years ago, literally, that when you, the water sources are up in the hills and you need to move those to where you want to plant crops. So they, and the farmers dug ditches and dug tunnels. And so they figured out that if you go down, you will find water. And then if you dig another tunnel, another well, and you can dig from that well to the well you dug before and draw the water. And so you would dig these wells until you got to the place you needed the water, where you wanted where the people were needing agriculture, congregating, civilizing, they needed to bring the water. So you see, as you're driving through the desert, you could look off and you'd see these lumps in a line. And if you followed you could follow a dotted line, basically, up to the hills. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating and extremely dangerous work. If you can imagine, you're going down sometimes hundreds of feet. Is that right? Down into the earth, depending on how far you were getting from the water source. You had to go deeper and deeper and deeper as you got to where you wanted the water to be. So these Qanats, they're called, are dug all over. They're all over the desert, and it's just so wonderful to see. But everywhere, then they end in an abanbar, which is the water storage place, and that's where the people go to get the water. And they build a big dome over it to keep it cool, to allow you to be able to them to make a stair step down to the bottom, a series of stairs, and you go down, and there's a little pool that they've made down. It's just amazing.
Hussein?
Yeah, these are mostly done in the desert area, in the eastern part of the country, and they're very elaborate. When I was in Morocco last year, I saw one in the desert. I hadn't seen Qanats in Iran before, and they had an oasis right in the middle of the desert, and I was surprised and asked my guide, where does the water come from? It was pretty big water stream coming and watering the oasis. And they said, well, this is coming from the desert. It comes from the mountain, the high Atlas there. And I said, wow, that's a very elaborate engineering. And he said, oh, we learned it from Iranians. They're the first Qanats were made in Iran. Mm. And that gets me back to your first question about Iran. The dwelling in Iran goes back like 10,000 years B.C. There are parts of the country that the first tribes moved in, along with Assyrians, Aryans, and these ethnicities that I talked about keep coming and going, and some survived, some got the power, so that we had different dynasties in Iran, different capitals depending on the dynasties. And Iran is invaded many times from the north, from the south, or from the east, West, by different groups, but the culture survived, the language survived. Iran was never a colonized country. And the empire of Iran during the first king that we had, Cyrus, and then subsequent Dariush, extended from beyond Egypt all the way to India, and from the north even to Mediterranean. Everywhere we went in the country, we were interested in the historical sites, the ruins, and in many, many places, we saw signs from Kurosh, or Cyrus, that is the Bill of Human Rights. The first Bill of Human Rights was written by Cyrus. And when he went to Egypt and Babylon, he freed, for example, the Jews and helped them to go to their homeland, Palestine, who were living coexisting with the Arabs. And for that reason, many of the historical sites show these carvings on the wall that shows how the people from different countries are coming during New Year, which is the first day of the spring, to pay tribute to the king. So he was winning the hearts of the countries that he conquered. The conquerors in Iran, on the other hand, would come and some destroy, like Alexander. He was a very young boy, but was very smart army soldier. He were able to conquer the Iran, but he burned it down. He could not tolerate all this magnificence. Like, he could not understand it. But later on, when he went to Egypt, he had learned a little bit from destruction of Iran, and he built something called Alexandria in the Mediterranean in Egypt. Well, he died fast. But then we had Huns who came, Genghis Khan, and they also invaded Iran. They burned. And then Arabs came, and they burned. They burned everything that was there. They said, we won't have Quran. If books that you have, then we had thousands of years of books. They said, if it's in Quran, then we don't need it. And if it's not in Quran, it's blasphemy. We should burn it. So, but again, Iran survived. Iran right now, as I said, is the 17th biggest country in the world, and the population is about 75 million, is the 17th. All these ethnicities live together in peace. There are no internal fights, and they're very welcoming to the foreigners. And that's why one of the reasons I didn't mind to be looked upon as a foreigner. I wanted to see how they treat us, not just the woman that they maybe have a different attitude toward, welcome them, but a man. And the reason they would take us, as a foreigner, because I had loose Western clothes and I have long hair and ponytail, and so it was very obvious that I'm not one of them. Mm-hmm. But as soon as we start talking to them, they would open up, they would embrace us, they would invite us to their house. And we're just walking in the street, talking. There's no string attached, but they would say, please come to my house after the conversation and we have a little lunch and continue conversation. And sometimes that we couldn't really go, they would get a little bit hurt. And that would really get Tammy's attention, and she would sometimes get emotional and cry.
Was it an emotional experience for you, Tammy?
Definitely, yeah. I've never been treated. I've never been treated so warmly by people. I was talking to a friend, and we agreed that whenever you go outside of the borders of the United States, you're always amazed by how nice everybody is and how much they know about America and Americans. And it's always, you always come away, or at least I do, I know most people do, come away thinking, man, the people there are so great. You know, that's like the primary thing that you come away from traveling with is, you know, the people were just great. And in Iran, not only are they great, but Americans don't know. They don't know how great they are. And that's like, that's the added little edge for me that, yeah, it's always the people that are the most impressive. But not only are they impressive, they're over the top, amazingly impressive. We would stop to ask directions, you know, is the thing over there? And they'd say, no, you got to go this way. It's a one-way street and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's lunchtime. Come on over. Mm-hmm. You know, as if we'd been friends for years. It was so common. We would sit down in a park to have or take a picnic. And, you know, and other people are doing that everywhere in the park. And one time we were sitting there having a park. We knew all eyes were on us because we were sticking out like sore thumbs, but we wanted to do what everybody else was doing. So we took our picnic to the park, laid out our sofre, they call it, a tablecloth, and sat down. And within 5 minutes, there was a guy from a nearby sofre with his family coming with a tray with two cups of tea on it for us. You know, don't know who you are. Welcome to Hamadan. We're happy to have you. You look like strangers. Where are you from? And he sat down and we had tea and I tried to make myself understood.
One thing I want to get into before we go to the next break is some of the culture that I know that you wanted to talk about and just the what it's like there as far as literary arts and maybe visual arts and that kind of thing. Is what can you say about that aspect of being in Iran?
Well, I knew a little bit about the importance of literature throughout the whole history of Iran, but I had no idea really how pervasive the understanding of that part of their history that Iranians carry with them. And, I mean, I frequently, somebody would quote something. I mean, I didn't understand what Hossein would translate later, but people would make little quotes from ancient Persian poetry, ancient literature that people are accustomed to memorizing long sequences of poetry. It's a very common thing there. And there's a particular piece of literature called the Shahnameh, written by a man, Ferdowsi. And he wrote it when, Hossein?
Oh, he wrote it in the 7th century.
7th century. So as the Arab invasion was taking hold. And he wanted to write down all this information that had been passed down just father to son, no writing involved. And before the Arabs could wash it away. And this it's volumes. I have a little tiny version of it in English that I started reading, but you realize, oh my gosh, these heroes and kings and gods and all this these battles, these are memorialized in right now. People name their son Rostam, who's the biggest figure in the Shahnameh. He lived for like 800 years or something, and he is woven through this whole volume. But they name their kids Rostam today. Anyway, does that paint a picture?
Yeah, and I guess I'm just asking Hossein, were you used to that, Hossein? Was that part of your culture growing up, that this integration of ancient history and poetry and art?
Yes, yes. I was a very big fan of, I was a big reader in Iran when I was a kid. My father, I never knew myself till later, about maybe 10 years before he died. He had memorized a whole Hafiz. Hafiz is a thick book. He's one of our biggest poets by heart. And the way I found out that they had brought this book for my brother, and we were sitting in Corvallis in a little apartment, and we had a very long hall, and I was sitting at one end. My mom was sitting in the middle with tea, and then my father was sitting at the end of the table way back there. And to keep him amused, I opened this Hafiz and I started reading. I had not finished the first verse that my father started citing the rest of it. And I looked up with tears in my eye. My mom said, yes, he is very literate. Mm-hmm. And all along, he didn't want me to go to literature because he wanted me to become a doctor or an engineer, so not to focus on literature, because he knew it's so capturing that if you turn into that, you will be distracted. But in school, we had literature courses all throughout the school. In 12th grade, we had poetries that we had to memorize and come in front of the class and recite it. When I was professor at the Shiraz University, I was in Shiraz. Shiraz is the home to Hafiz. That's where his tomb is also there. Many people at that age, my age, who were in the even the university community, had Hafiz memorized. And it's like hundreds of pages. Mm. And we have big poets like Khayyam that has been translated to many different languages, into English many, many times by English poet Edgar Fitzgerald. And we saw things in Iran that really still continuation of the same. We witnessed, Tammy and I, and on the TV, that they had this poetry contest between very youth people, between 12 to 14 years old. And one would start reading a poetry and would recite 5-6 verses. And then the other one had to start his own with a letter that the previous one had ended and continue going. And this was amazing. Mm. In my time, it was there, but it was shorter. But they were all older people who had really matured. These were younger, very young people. We have very good writers now. We always had, but now the number of writers is more than I used to remember when I was in Iran myself. We've had always great poets. Today we have still great poets and writers.
You're listening to Hossein Rajantalab, and also with me is Tammy Dean, and we're talking about their experiences in their recent 7-month-long trip to Iran. We are going to hear another short bit of music. Hossein, do you want to tell us about this one?
Yes, this is by one of our contemporary singers. His name is Mohammad Shajarian. He's in the States right now. He's going to write a love poem. It's called Khosro Shirin, and it's from a Abu Atta concert that he had here. به دشت افتاد مجنون، آخ به دشت افتاد مجنون، زار و دل thank you.
شب از آتشی آخ شب از آتشی آه شهر بر نمایان بود
back. I'm here with Tammy Dean and Hossein Rajantalab continuing our discussion of their trip to Iran. Hossein, we've talked about the incredible diversity that you experienced both in landscape and in the groups of people that you encountered. How much traveling did it actually take you to see those people?
Oh, what a wonderful question. When we went to Iran, we bought a brand new car for about $8,000. It was absolutely in good condition for us to travel. We traveled 16,500 miles in a span of 5 months because the time that we went to Tehran, we didn't drive much. And we drove fantastic roads. To get to those ethnical groups, we had to really drive far and long. Of course, Iran has 31 provinces and about 12 islands. Of these islands, two or three are inhabited. And we would drive to the main city of each province, and then we had information where to go to see the historical sites, and then we would mingle with people. There was a lot of roads. It was really totally surprising to me to have this kind of a good road. They were not just paved. They were just smooth. Way up in the Zagros Mountains, up to 8,000-9,000 feet, and magnificent, magnificent sceneries. I've traveled in Europe. I've traveled in Alps. But I haven't seen something like this before. And then there were people there, Iranian people, were also traveling. I think the roads that they've made has helped the villages to commute to the cities and go back. When we didn't have a road, it was usually a one-way flow. People from villages were just left alone, and they would go back to cities, and then the villages would get depleted. I didn't see as many now depleted. In fact, we didn't see any. But there were some really flourishing, and some, it was ironic, in the Khorramabad, in Lorestan province, for example, we were trying to go to the mountains, but we could not get the road. Everybody just directed us to the highways. And there are big two, three-lane highways on each side. But we insisted to go through the mountains. And finally, after 2 hours of really asking here and there, and it was getting a little dark, there was a boy who was not probably as worse as the others, directed us to go to the mountainside. It was so awesome, but it was a lowish size, and later we found out that they really didn't want the tourists to go there because they wanted to keep it pristine. They didn't want to have their flocks to be in danger of the cars driving. They wanted to have their own privacy. So they had made all these roadblocks as though we have had some landslides. But there wasn't. It was ironic, but it was really beautiful. But then when we get there, they were as open as, you know, hospitable as any, because if we respected them and they took us in.
I wanted to ask you about economically how people are doing in Iraq and a little bit about the comparison between Iraq and the United States, especially about Iran. I'm sorry. I did that before. I'm sorry about that. Iran, about Iran and the difference in economic status for people. If you noticed that, if that was evident, if there is a wide disparity like there is in the United States, how did that happen?
That's such an interesting question. And I probably can't answer it as well as Hossein. For myself, I noticed definitely that coming back to Tehran the several times that we did was always kind of a blast, because Hossein's family primarily lives in a very upper middle class part of the city, and the metro stations are beautiful. It's very smooth running, seemingly, nice shopping areas, that kind of thing. It reminded me a lot of New York. However, when we would go off into the hinterlands, you'd see all kinds of different ways of making a living. Everything from Tupan, the shepherds that were nomadically moving their flocks around. They're very, they live really on the edge. I don't know. There were extremes, but not that I noticed in any particular place. Hossein, mm-hmm. You should answer more.
Yeah. In our travel, as I said, we saw 31, 28 of the 31 provinces and two of the islands. The disparity is there, just like in the States. There are many, many very rich people. You don't see them. The Bazaaris, some have really made a lot of money, but
that's the people who live in who work in the bazaar.
Yeah, big merchants. Mm-hmm. But what the people told me all over these 28 provinces was that the sanctions have really made a big burden, such a big burden on their life. We were up in a little village up in the Alborz Mountains in Gilan province. It's called Jawahar Dare. Jawahar means like gold, jewelry. And Dare means a valley. And it's really pretty as like that. And then we had to go through a windy road, and it was many people there. We came to this woman who was making bread in a little bread-making oven that she had, sitting on the ground, and we just sat by her, and she's smiling at us and making this bread and gave us the bread, and then turned to Tammy or to Shabnam and told her in Farsi, tell Obama to lift the sanctions. It's really killing us. Mm-hmm. So it is very hard. We saw prices increase as we were there. In the 7 months, we saw the prices go up by at least 10-15%.
Do you think the people are hopeful at all after the elections there, which you were there for? We haven't really talked about.
Yeah, I think people are hopeful. They're very hopeful. They make a joke about Hassan
Rouhani.
Thank you. You're Rojan Talab. He's Rouhani. About Hassan Rouhani talking to Hussein Obama. They say, we heard Hassan called Hussein on the telephone the other day. They had a long discussion.
And Hassan and Hussein are two brothers. That's why, the two imams.
Yeah.
Hassan was the second imam, and Hussein was the third imam, and Hussein was the martyr, and they all. So
it's a very positive light that people are looking at this.
Yeah, I mean, the election night, it was really people in the streets till early mornings. I mean, crowded, just joyful. Yes, they were ready for a change. There are, of course, the opposition who doesn't want this talks with the West to go on about the nuclear armament or nuclear progress in Iran. But there are some moderates who really are serious, and they know economically they have to do it. And they are, I think, they're genuine.
Mm-hmm. We only have about 2 minutes left, and I want to ask you what you would like to say in the last couple of minutes of this interview that maybe we haven't covered.
Iran is ready for tourists. We saw that in the south. Hotels are there, beautiful, beautiful Sunnati, traditional houses that you can sit there in the courtyard with other tourists sitting there. There's a big, nice courtyard. There's a lot of gardens. There's a little water feature there with the sprinkles. The rooms are perfectly kept from traditional Qajar area. It's just awesome. We saw it in all over the south, and they're really comfortable. In the south, we saw a lot of tourists. So it's safe, and you should not really listen to this media that scares you from Iran. They are ready for you.
How about you, Tammy?
I would say, please, everybody should at least make an attempt to get to know a little bit about Iran, because it's not the place that your government says it is. I wanted to mention a couple books.
Okay.
I read a book called Missing Soluch, S-O-L-U-C-H, by a man named Dolat Abadi. That's hard to remember, but if you just Google Missing Soluch, it's a great, wonderful look at life in the desert. Very celebrated novel. Another one called Savushun, S-A-V-U-S-H-U-N, by a woman named Danishvar. Savushun would be another good one to look up. And another one, Saved by Beauty, by a British journalist, Roger Housden. Saved by Beauty.
And maybe I could get those from you, Tammy, and I'll add those to the material on this show that will be on the KBOO website.
And if you want to go to Iran, you have to go through some agencies.
Okay, so they would have to go through a special agency to get there.
Yes, yes. Okay. You find them in the net.
Okay. Okay. Hossein Rajantalab and Tammy Dean, thank you very much for coming in and talking about your trip and all your enthusiasm. It's wonderful to have you here sharing this information. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you, Kathleen, for inviting us.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I want to let people know that we are KBOO Portland, and coming up will be Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, followed by Flashpoints, and then The Digital Divide.
I want to say thank you.
Oh, and thank you. Thank you, Sam. Thanks. Sam Parrish, our engineer.
You couldn't put the last music.
Yeah.
Non-commercial FM radio station KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon, gives notice that on October 29, 2013, an application, FCC Form 315, for consent to transfer control of the license from the old board to the new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yemin. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. The KBOO Foundation, licensee of non-commercial FM radio station KBOO 90.7, Portland, Oregon, gives notice that on October 29, 2013, an application, FCC Form 315, for consent to transfer control of the license from the old board to the new board of directors was filed with the Federal Communications Commission. Officers and directors of the old board were Paula Small, Michael Papadopoulos, Hadrian Machiche, S.W. Conser, Mark Brown, Lynn Mollick, Lisa Loving, Jeff Kippelman, John Mackey, Damon Isaiah Turner, Matthew Bristow, and Rabia Yemin. Officers and directors of the new board are Matthew Bristow, Adine Rogovin, Mark Sherman, Susan Bartlett, Joe Uris, Jennifer Davis, Michael Wells, Lynn Mollick, S.W. Conser, Michael Papadopoulos, Timothy Welp, and Jeff Kippelman. A copy of the application and related materials are available for public inspection at KBOO's main studio at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, between the hours of 9 a.m. and 5 p.m., Monday through Friday.